Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Trump CNN town hall and the big house GOP Biden money investigation. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
I'm good, Andy. How are you?
I'm good. We got the Mets got their first competently pitched game in 3 weeks last night. So, you know, you pay $90 million for 40-year-old pitchers, you ought to get a decent outing every now and again.
This is why, Andy, terrible. By the way, I mentioned a friend who skips the first minute or so of the podcast, and I was with Megan Kelly the other day, and she's a listener, which is the good news, but the bad news is she also skips the first minute or two. So this is why, Andy. Chatter. Losing us listeners in the early going every podcast.
I'm setting my alarm so that 20 minutes from now I can make a baseball reference for Megan.
So she can't avoid it. All right, so speaking of unavoidable, Donald Trump, holy cow, we're recording
love
Thursday
that segue.
Morning. Yeah, he did this town hall on CNN. I must confess, I had some other stuff going on. I forgot about it, but I watched a bunch of clips, so I'm pretty sure I have a pretty good flavor of it. You know, Bill O'Reilly was on, I go on this show with Sid Rosenberg and WABC in New York City every Monday and listen to it. I love Sid. He's just a great radio guy, and he has Bill O'Reilly on regularly, and he was asking O'Reilly, why is Trump doing this? You know, why is he going to CNN, giving them the credibility, or, you know, they'll murder him. What is he doing? He's like, no, this makes total sense. He'll totally steamroll or Caitlin Collins. And Bill O'Reilly, with his accustomed modesty, is like, only I can handle a Trump in an interview. No one else can, but certainly not Caitlin Collins. And he was totally right about that. Not that she, you know, wasn't well informed and knows stuff. It's just she doesn't have a big enough personality to stand up to this guy. Very few people do. And I mean, he littered the place with ammunition for Democrats to use against him in the fall, but demonstrated once again just how incredibly formidable he is in Republican politics.
Yeah, it's a force of nature. I did watch it because my viewing alternative, Megan, is the Mets. So it seemed like it would be more entertainment. And it was, and this is the problem, or one of the problems. He's a very entertaining guy. He's got a tremendous sense of comic talent, comic timing. And this was a setting in which, as you say, and as O'Reilly said, you know, this was going to be a steamroll, and it was. I think, you know, Caitlin Collins seemed like, she seems like, you know, I'm sure she's a very competent journalist in her own element, but there's nothing normal about this. So it's like she's there to impose the rules of chess, but she finds herself in the middle of a wrestling cage match.
Yeah.
And the crowd is with the wrestler. So it's not just Trump, it's that you have a crowd that's eating out of his hand.
Yeah.
And I just think it's, I have something about half written on this, but I just think for those who are in my camp, like the he can't win camp, this was like the nightmare scenario of all nightmares, because I mean, here we are 24 hours after he gets found liable for sexual abuse, which we'll get to. And in a world where it would be normal to turn somebody with his track record and with that, you know, very fresh event in mind, you would turn a person like that into a pariah. You would either give him no airtime, or if you found yourself for whatever reason forced into a situation where you had to share a stage with him, you would make it clear that you felt revulsion to be put in that position. That's what would happen with the normal person. Instead, you have this symbiotic, weird relationship between Trump and CNN, where they're good for each other. Collins treats him like you would treat a normal politician who you were covering as a journalist, which in and of itself, just the body language of that is helpful to him. I mean, even the amazing thing to me, Rich, was toward the end, he got himself fired up because she had the temerity to correct, you know, like the millionth thing that he said that wasn't true. She jumped on him and corrected him. And he looked at her. He said, "Boy, you're a nasty person." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed like 5 or 10 minutes later, CNN, first of all, in a Biden-like fashion, they called a lid on it like 10 minutes early. I think they decided it was like a technical knockout. They could have gone. They had the time reserved to go another 10 or 15 minutes, and they just called it early, I guess, because it was going the way it was going. But then, you know, she amiably shakes hands with him as the audience applauds at the end. So that whole imagery just helps him.
Yeah.
But the thing is, what it does is it gets the Trump base on its high horse, because they're like, see, he's the only one who can do this. He's the only one who can go into the lion's den and roll over them. I think it even helps them that AOC and other critics of CNN last night, but AOC, I guess, most prominently on the progressive left, are carping about what a disgrace it was that CNN did this, because that has the Trump base saying, see, he not only went in there and crushed them, he has them having catfights with each other. They're, you know, he's the only one who can do this. And it's going to cow a lot of Republican opposition. The only time that you could control this guy is if you had like a debate format where he actually had to shut up for 2 or 3 minutes while somebody like, say, Chris Christie, you know, gave it to him between the eyes. But Christie doesn't have any chance of winning the nomination. So what you're going to get is a bunch of Republican nominees. I hope DeSantis doesn't follow this track, but you worry that they worry too much about insulting Trump's base or getting under their skin. So they'll tiptoe around him. And I think Christie's entirely right that the only way to go after this guy is to go after him. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to want to do that. So it makes it much more likely that he wins the nomination. And if he wins the nomination, he's going to get friggin' killed in the general election. CNN is not going to be doing this once he's the nominee.
Yeah, so I'm in a different place on that.
I know.
On that question. But so I totally thought about the wrestling thing as well when they're standing, especially. You know, she was next to this towering guy, and she was sort of like the straight man reporter, and you know, as if she was part of the skit, you know, to make this wrestler look even more fearsome and formidable. And and I was also struck by he calls her a nasty person, gets applause, you know, and then she just reads her script. But what are you supposed to do in that moment? It's really, for her, it's really hard. And why did, so this is something I didn't pick up in the clip. So why did they end up standing? Who stood up first, and how did that happen?
When they came back from a commercial, they were up.
Okay. All right.
So they had been sitting, and I think they just, it's like what you do at a town hall, I guess. I don't know how they choreograph these things, but that's how it was. And I kept thinking the same thing you're thinking. And I thought, you know, in a perfect world here, there'd be a backdrop and somebody would put a light on behind them in the scenery that said Bergdorf Goodman or something. Yeah. You know? But it didn't happen. And I was wondering, you know, I take O'Reilly's point only because Trump is kind of weird about, you know, celebrity and people who he thinks have gravitas. I wonder, like, let's say it had been, you know, we talk Megan or O'Reilly or, I don't know, you know, pick your solid journalist with a lot of respect type. Could someone like that control him in this kind of a, I mean, with the crowd, I think it was like the worst of all worlds. It's like how they filled the crowd with Trumpies. And maybe I'm just thinking that because they always punch above their weight, so they were louder than everyone else. But it sure seemed between the way that people reacted to what he said and the quality of the questions, which were very friendly softball type questions for the most part, that it was a real pro-Trump crowd. I mean, that was a total
no doubt.
CNN put it on and it was a road game for them.
Yeah. So the thing, other interviewers would be better able to control him and challenge him. But the thing is, at the end of the day, he never feels defensive about anything, never shows any defensiveness. So it would have been harder for him to steamroll someone else, but it wouldn't have been, he wouldn't have been hurt, you know, by someone else. I don't think it's just this weird impregnable quality he has.
Yeah. Well, you have to have a format where he has to be quiet and somebody else gets to talk and then lay out, here's the dozen reasons why what he just said is either absurd, wrong, or both. And I don't know that, why should he, given the, this is like what Nikki Haley said the other day, given how far ahead he is in the polls, and given this dynamic, why should he subject himself to that kind of a format? You know, they could have, they could schedule a Republican debate and he could get, you know, Tucker or CNN or somebody to put him on at the same time and no one will watch the debate.
Yeah. But one of my takeaways from last night is, I was, you know, maybe it's a mercy to the other candidates that if Trump doesn't show up in a debate or at a debate. So two things really quickly, and we'll segue into the verdict. So one, if there was any doubt that Trump is all in on January 6th and it has been totally shifted around in his mind and the mind of a lot of his supporters into something to be celebrated or at least vigorously defended, last night removed it.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about pardoning people who were complicit in it. He didn't seem to, you know, it wasn't clear if he was drawing a line between people who just, you know, wandered through the Capitol versus, say, you know, the rabble-rouser groups that were, you know, in the front lines of the violence. I don't know that he makes a distinction in his mind about that. But he also said he didn't owe Pence an apology because Pence did something wrong. So he's completely all in on that. And again, you know, I know you and I are not in the same place on this, but when I hear people say that this is teeing up just like 2016, where you have a Democratic candidate of historic awfulness, and what was being said in 2016 was that there's no way Trump can win. I think the 2016 Trump is not this Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the Trump who has already had a chance. It's not like people can take it, can say, well, you know, we know what she's going to be. Let's see what this guy. We already have seen. And the people that he needs to roll the dice and take a chance on him, a goodly number of those are not coming out to vote for him. Mm-hmm. They're not coming home at the end like they did in 2016. They're just not. And that doesn't mean they're going to vote for Biden. They're just not going to show up, which means it'll be less work for the Democrats to beat him. So I just, when he doubles down on the Capitol riot and he says things last night like, you know, what we need to have is a default, you know, I think that McCarthy's done a really solid job that I certainly didn't credit him that he'd be able to pull this off. And he's like trying to herd cats. We're going to maybe talk a little bit about this later, but I think the Democrats took an interesting shot at him yesterday by indicting Santos, because that potentially eats into his very razor thin margin that he has if they can mau-mau people into throwing Santos out of Congress, you know, before this vote has to happen. But here's McCarthy trying to stitch together this careful strategy, and there's Trump on, you know, who has a lot of influence over House Republicans, saying we have to default, just have to default, just have to do it. All of this stuff is going to be a catastrophe for Republicans in the general election, but right now, his people are eating it up.
Yeah, so there's no doubt that the two big winners last several months, Trump and Democrats who want to run against Trump with as much baggage as possible. So another part of the interview got a lot of attention at the town hall was the way Trump talked about the Jean Carroll allegation. And I have to say, he sort of crystallized the doubts that I expressed in a past episode in a really hilarious and kind of compelling way that made it seem completely ridiculous. You know, this 55-year-old woman, right? Was that how old she was at the time? It seems...
No, he lied. He said he called her 60 yesterday. 52, yeah, yeah. She was.
52, okay. 50. And within minutes, you know, they're in a dressing room in a very public place. I think there is an implausibility to it, but what did you think of his telling of it last night and how he presented it? And then we'll get into the actual legal nitty gritty.
It made me think he would have, he might have won the case if he had shown up and testified.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he would say is a lot of the things that he says that resonate with people were precluded by the judge. But I just think that's ridiculous. He explained what he explained like no one else can. And Rich, I think for a goodly part of this jury, if not all, it's human nature, which jurors have to overcome in criminal cases, because you get told in criminal cases that you can't construe silence against the defendant. And juries, even though that's an intellectually hard thing to do, juries try really hard to follow what the judge says and just decide the case based on, you know, what the government's evidence is. But there's not a single case where there's a serious allegation of wrongdoing where the jurors don't want the accused to get up, sit in the witness stand, take the oath, look him in the eye, and tell him that he didn't do it. And that's what they wanted from him. I mean, he blew off the trial and he didn't show up. Now, unlike a CNN town hall, in a trial, you have to answer hostile questions, and if you don't, the judge can make you look terrible. And, you know, Judge Kaplan would have run his courtroom very differently than how Caitlin Collins ran her, her town hall last night. So he would not have had the I'm just going to roll over my opposition effect that he had on television last night. But I think you still saw, especially in the narrative way that he told it, and he would have been a very hard witness for a defense lawyer to control in a trial. He would have been a compelling witness. He may not have convinced them. Maybe he would have gotten so beaten up on cross that by the end, they would have rejected his testimony. But this is what was missing from the trial. You know, what you saw last night was what he was not willing to do, which was sit in the witness stand and tell that story. Now, there's a couple of aspects of it that he's been leaning on that the judge ruled out of the trial. Like, he wants to make a big deal about who was paying her legal fees, which really is something that, generally speaking, in court, you can't get into in a trial. It's not like he's been singled out for treatment here on that. He wants to get into the fact that she had a cat named Vagina, and he kept saying that.
Is that true?
Loops about the, yeah, I didn't know that until last night, but there you go. I mean, that's yet another thing. Now, the suggestion, you know, I saw Byron York tweeted something to the effect of, you know, if you didn't know that, nobody knew that until last night. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember the judge ruling that out of the case, so I don't know that he couldn't have referred to that when he was on the stand or not. But the point is, he didn't show up. He didn't come. He didn't tell that story that he told last night under circumstances where he could be cross-examined on it. So you have to factor that part of it in. I just think that all of the things he was able to say last night in the narrative way, without being controlled, without being asked hostile questions, absolutely show that he was the right person to convey that message to the jury, and really the only one they wanted to hear it from, and he wouldn't do it.
Yeah. So what about the odd split nature of this verdict, where they say, no, we're not finding him guilty on your main charge that he raped you, but we are finding him guilty of a lesser charge based on predilections demonstrated by these two propensity witnesses, as you've called them, other women who Trump aggressively came on to, and his Access Hollywood tape. So we're believing you, but just not totally believing you.
Yeah. So I think a lot of this, Rich, has to do with people misunderstanding what the nature of a jury verdict is. You know, we want to look at the world as kind of, you know, black and white. You either prove something or the proposition is rejected. And that's not really what a jury does. The jury may have believed Carol that she was raped, but they may not have believed that she proved it sufficiently that they could be comfortable drawing that conclusion. It's clear that they believed that there was an incident between Trump and Carol. They rejected the idea that she was making this up. They accepted her testimony probably because it was supported by those two contemporaneous report witnesses, one of whom testified that she called like 10 minutes after it happened, and another one who said it was within the first couple of days after it happened. So I think they definitely accepted that something went on between Trump and Carol, and thus rejected the idea that, like, Trump didn't say this other than in his deposition, but, you know, this idea that he didn't even know who she was, and, you know, that part, you know, by the way, his deposition was a catastrophe for him in the, it'll be a bigger catastrophe for him probably politically, but it was not good for him in the trial. But I think, so you start from the premise that they accepted her testimony that something happened between them. There's no physical corroboration for it because there's 27 years that elapses between, well, 25 years elapse between the time that it happens and the time she goes public about it. And by then, you can't do any scientific testing. Trump wanted to make a big deal about the fact that they did do scientific testing on her dress that she says she was wearing that day, and the judge precluded that. What he doesn't mention is the judge precluded it because there's no evidence in the case that he ejaculated or that there would have been any kind of DNA testing that would have been useful on the dress. And the defense was able to make all those arguments. So, you know, what he's making into a big deal is not a big deal.
I was hoping we were going to make it through the lifetime of this podcast without ever using the E word on this podcast, Andy.
Well, there we go. I used the V word 5 minutes ago and I slipped it by you. So
just for the name of a cat. That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like Siri didn't like that either, apparently. but anyway, there was no evidence of that. In all honesty, I have found it so difficult to talk about this case because who wants to talk about that stuff? But of course, it's the only way that you could talk about a case like this.
Sure.
But the thing is, so there's no scientific evidence. Juries always want corroboration. So what do they have? They have testimonial corroboration of a sort, which is this propensity evidence that we've talked about a number of times. And you have these two victim witnesses and the Access Hollywood tape. And the two victim witnesses talk about sexual abuse, inappropriate touching, but they don't allege rape. On the Access Hollywood tape, Trump talks about sexual abuse, inappropriate touching, but he doesn't claim to have raped anyone. And what the jury ended up saying was, we're willing to go with sexual abuse and inappropriate touching, but we're not going to the extent of rape because the only things all the witnesses say are sexual abuse and inappropriate touching. And the only witness who says rape is Carol. And even her testimony is weird about this. I don't want to get graphic again, but she let's just say that under the circumstances, giving what she says was her hysteria, she was more feeling than watching what was going on down there. And she was a little bit back and forth about how much happened down there and exactly what it was. So even her testimony is not the strongest on this. And the other thing, which, Rich, by the way, I didn't really even think of this until you and I discussed it offline, and you brought this point up, which made me remember some of the testimony. But the contemporaneous witness, the important one, Lisa Birnbach, what the testimony of both Carol and Birnbach is that Carol told her the story without claiming that she, without using the R word, without claiming that she was raped. And it was Birnbach who said to her, "He raped you," which was, she said, like the first time that it sort of hit her like a cold slap in the face that was what happened. Now, look, it either was or it wasn't on the basis of what physically she described, you know, whether she used the R word or not. But it could have been that, you know, they were troubled by her ambivalence herself of calling it what she says it was. But I think what happened here clearly is they didn't reject her testimony. They weren't comfortable that rape got proved. And as far as they were concerned, and by the way, this is an important conclusion too. What the judge tells them is the charge is battery. So it's not like they get told, rape, guilty or not guilty. What they get told is the charge is battery. There's three theories of battery: rape, sexual abuse, and inappropriate touching. Any one of those three is sufficient to make out battery. Mm-hmm. So they knew that if they said sexual abuse and inappropriate touching, it didn't matter whether they drew the conclusion of rape or not, because that was enough to prove battery. It wasn't like it was teed up for the jury that the charge in this case is rape, yes or no. That's really not the way it was pitched to them.
So I heard Alan Dershowitz on the Sid Rosenberg radio show, my main source, obviously, of news and analysis. But it was actually a great interview. And Dershowitz said, this is just flawed. You can't find that she was wrong about the main thing, contrary to what you were just the way you were just analyzing it, and then say Trump defamed her by denying it in the harshest possible terms. So this thing, and I'm simplifying what he was saying, but this thing will be overturned on an appeal. There's no way it won't be.
Yeah, I think Alan's he could be right in a bottom line way, but it won't be because of the reason that he articulated. Courts of appeals do not throw out cases on the grounds that the verdict is irrational. Because in our system, we don't encourage it, but we permit compromise verdicts. I tried a guy years ago, Saeed Nosair, who had killed Meir Kahani in front of about 100 people.
Mm-hmm. Horrible, yeah.
But the thing is, the New York jury, before we convicted him in our case of seditious conspiracy, the New York jury in the murder case acquitted him of murder and convicted him of possessing the gun that was proved to have committed the murder and of using it on another occasion during. So the verdict was, as the trial judge, whose name was Alan Schlesinger, I think, he said the verdict, when he sentenced Nosair to the maximum you could get for a gun charge, which was clearly a proxy for sentencing him for the murder, he said that the jury's verdict was against all rationality. But it didn't get thrown out on appeal because we allow compromise verdicts. And what obviously happened was the jury compromised. There was some that didn't want to convict him of murder, so they agreed to convict him on the guns. Mm-hmm. Courts of appeals don't throw out a
verdict because it's irrational. As I just explained, I don't really think this verdict was irrational. In fact, I think, you know, to the extent that Trump is arguing that he got railroaded, I think he's going to have a very hard time convincing people of that, because it looks to me like the jury went carefully through what the evidence was and was not willing to go the distance of saying he raped her, because they didn't think there was enough evidence of that. But there was a lot of evidence of the other kinds of sexual abuse that they found. So it does look like the jury made a discriminating appraisal of the evidence, even if it was not the appraisal that a lot of people would have agreed with. Where I think Trump has some traction is, it's one thing to say that the rules of evidence have been loosened up to allow propensity evidence in sexual abuse cases. It's quite another thing to say that the judge, you know, can let in so much propensity evidence that it can be seen as overwhelming the evidence of the charged act. And in this instance, you have very little evidence of the charged act. I mean, you have basically Carol's testimony and the two contemporaneous witnesses and no forensic backup. And yet the judge let in two, not one, but two witnesses who say they were sexually abused by Trump, even though their stories have some elements of similarity with Carol's, but they don't completely match up. And he let in this Access Hollywood tape, which, you know, there's a lot of admissions against interest on Trump's part on the tape, but the tape doesn't have anything to do with Carol's case, except in the most general sense. So I think if I'm Trump's counsel arguing on appeal, what I argue is that there's supposed to be a balance between the proof of the thing that's charged and the other evidence of other crimes and bad acts that a judge allows in the case. And if you lose that balance, what ends up happening is a defendant can be convicted on the basis of the things that aren't charged rather than the thing that is charged. Mm-hmm. I still think that's probably a loser argument, but it's a loser argument only because the law has been loosened up since the mid-1990s to allow this kind of evidence in sexual abuse cases. So the Court of Appeals, I think, will end up saying, look, we don't like this. We're very uncomfortable with this. In other kinds of cases, we don't permit a situation where the propensity evidence overwhelms the evidence of the charged act. But here, we're dealing with legislatures that have changed the law, and we have to follow what they've done, even if we don't think it's a great mm-hmm. idea.
Let me pause and do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalview.com. Your way around our metered paywall. Your way, if you sign up and log in, to see about 90% fewer ads, especially the most obnoxious and annoying ads, disappear as if by magic. Your way to dig deeper into the NR community, if that floats your boat, to comment on articles and blog posts, to be invited to exclusive calls and events with NR writers, editors, and other conservative figures. A little later this afternoon, I am doing one of these calls for NR Plus members with Chip Roy, who's right in the center of the border controversy and the debt ceiling fight, and is a great conservative warrior, great friend of both mine and Andy's. And it's a really important way, if you sign up for NR Plus, to support our journalism, which is valuable and deserves to have people, I would submit to you, pay for it, which would just be wonderful. And tens of thousands of people do it already. If you don't do it already, please consider joining your fellow National Review readers. So, Andy, we have these bombshell House negotiations ongoing. We have one on Biden money, family money. There's a press conference yesterday, Romanian angle that I wasn't aware of, about $1 million funneled in. A lot of this money would go to various companies that would end up writing checks to all sorts of Biden family members. And we also have new revelations about that shameful letter from the former intelligence officials about the Hunter Biden laptop. But where are we on the money?
Well, I have to say, Rich, I've been critical of Jamie Comer, who was the chairman of the Oversight Committee, when I thought that he was conducting some of the oversight issues in a way that was susceptible of being sort of portrayed as being Trump's defense lawyer rather than, you know, just straightforward doing his oversight job. I need to compliment him here because I really thought they did a very good job yesterday. They've done a good job on this investigation, and he did a terrific job yesterday giving an overview of the Biden money. And look, we've been talking about this for a couple of years, right? So we're not stunned by any of this. As you say, the Romanian angle is interesting. That's one that hasn't gotten attention up until now. But most of this is the China angle, right? And the Ukraine stuff. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about that for years. But it was still, there's still, you know, number one, there's nothing like subpoena power, which he's had and Comer has had and has wielded well for the last 5 months, which has really advanced the investigation. And he did a superb job giving an overview of what they found. And then they let, they had about six or seven members speak, ending with Congressman Donald from Florida, who Byron Donald, I think,
yeah,
who's very effective, good speaker, who made some excellent points at the end, and then let Jim Jordan finish, and he's very effective. So it was a very well done conference. But the, you know, the main thing, Rich, that they hammer home is that there's no value being exchanged. You know, there's millions of dollars that are being exchanged. And in any legitimate transaction where $1 million goes from one party to the other, you can usually see, or you can always see, an asset, a commodity, a service, something that's worth that value. Like one of the members yesterday said that, you know, you can say what you want about Trump and his business, but, you know, when he does a billion-dollar transaction and it's some kind of a real estate venture, you can go to Scotland and see the real estate. You know, you can go to Scotland and see the golf course or whatever it is that they've that's at the heart of the transaction. In this instance, there's no commodity or value at all. And the only thing that resembles something like that is access to Joe Biden or his political influence There is nothing else. And for that reason, the other thing that's very fishy here is that in a legitimate transaction, no matter how much money is involved, if it's a fair exchange of money for something of value, it's easy to see the transaction. You know, money changes hands, even in large amounts, and then an asset or a commodity comes the other way. Here, under circumstances where there appears to be no asset or commodity, there's no simple transaction. Every transaction is, you know, we have 17 different LLCs, and we have four or five different banking channels that get used, and one transaction turns into 17 transactions, and they break it down into little bits, and they push it through different LLCs, and there are different Bidens on the receiving end of it. And the only people who do business like that are people who are trying to cover up the fact that they got the money and what the money was for. I mean, this is the kind of money laundering type activity that you see constantly in organized crime cases, where it's proceeds that are generated by illegal activity, or at least activity that they don't want anyone to know how they got the money in the first place. And then they carve it up into different transactions in order to not look fishy to the banking authorities, which itself, by the way, often causes the banking authorities to be suspicious. One of the things that the House relied on in its report yesterday is that there's 170 suspicious activity reports. And I'm not sure, you know, they kept talking about them as SARs. I'm not sure that people understand what SARs are. So there are federal laws that control currency transactions. And they're designed to, they really are designed to detect money laundering and narcotics trafficking activities. But basically, if you're going to do a domestic transaction worth more than $10,000 in currency, or if you do a foreign transaction involving more than $5,000 in currency, you have to fill out what's known as a currency transaction report. So what people do is they try to beat the reporting requirement. Now, if you're doing legitimate business, no one is worried about the reporting requirement. You know, if I deposit $10,000 in cash in a bank, and it's because I'm in a cash business and I made, you know, $10,000, then that, who cares? I don't care if I have to fill out a report. But if I did it, if I have $25,000 that's my cut of a drug deal, then I don't want to fill out a currency transaction report. So what I'm going to do instead of depositing $10,000 is I'm going to break up that $25,000 into, say, five $5,000 transactions, and I'll go to five different banks, or I'll bring the same bank 5,000 at a time so I don't hit the 10,000 mark. When the bank sees that kind of stuff, they're suspicious. So even though it's not a crime, it triggers their suspicions that something fishy is going on, and they fill out what's known as a suspicious activity report. It can be because of the way a financial transaction is structured, or it can be because of who a financial transaction is with. So if, for example, you're getting money from Russian sources or weird Chinese sources, that may prompt the bank to do a suspicious activity report. We know, for example, that one of these reports had something to do with Hunter paying money to a prostitution ring that had an email address that had an RU at the end of it for Russia, which triggered all kinds of suspicions in the financial train that it had to go through. So what Comer is showing is that the only commodity here is access to Joe Biden and Joe Biden's political influence. There's no other value, and that they're cutting up these transactions in a labyrinthine web of LLCs and banking channels rather than conducting business like you would conduct it if you had a legitimate business transaction with value going one way and money coming the other way. So that's the main thing. And they did a very good job of showing it.
So what's the key thing, as I understand it, on the letter is that Blinken was involved?
Right. So Antony Blinken at the time is a advisor to the Trump campaign, to the Biden campaign. And he is slated to become, as he did become, Secretary of State if Biden won. So he calls up his friend from the Obama days when he was deputy Secretary of State. He calls up Mike Morrell, who was Deputy CIA Director under Petraeus, and then Obama made him acting CIA director before Brennan. And at the time, I think Morrell gave it looks to be pretty forthright testimony to the committee and admitted that they were absolutely playing politics on this. He says that his participation in this was because he wanted Biden to win the election. He also says that he truly believes that Russia screws around in our elections, although that's not very compelling because he can't identify any particular way that he thought that the Biden reporting by the New York Post was Russian disinformation. They burble something about, well, you know, the Post got the information through Rudy and Steve Bannon, and, you know, they have shady connections. You know, they, in point of fact, they have nothing on Russia, right? So they're basically making it up. I'm not saying they don't think Russia interferes in our elections, but I think everybody knows Russia interferes in our mm-hmm. elections. That's not like a get out of jail free card for every stupid thing you do, right?
Yeah, yeah. No reason to try to mislead the public about Hunter Biden's laptop to the Russians right. interfere in our election.
So anyway, Morrell says he's got no intention at all of writing a letter or accusing the Post of peddling Russian disinformation or anything like that. But he gets a call from his old pal Blinken, who says to him, "Have you read the New York Post reporting?" And he hadn't read it. And he said, what do you think about the Russians interfering in our election? And they had this elliptical conversation where Blinken says enough to him to understand that this is October 17th, and there's a presidential debate scheduled on October 22nd, the last of the presidential debates. And they know that Trump is going to throw the Hunter reporting at Biden during the debate. So Blinken says enough to Morrell to make him understand that they need something in the way of pushback that Biden will be able to use. But he doesn't tell him in so many words, you need to write a letter and get a bunch of people to sign on. But just in case he didn't get the message loud and clear, at the end of their conversation, Blinken emails him an article from the USA Today about the Biden New York Post reporting on the laptop from hell, in which the USA Today suggests that this may all be Russian disinformation because of the Rudy connection to it. So that's how the letter gets started. Morrell says that he didn't have any intention of actually doing a letter, but it was after this conversation with Blinken that it came into his mind to do it. And we now also know, Rich, guess who the you may know this already, but remember the what they say in the letter is that this has all the earmarks of Russian disinformation or a Russian influence operation, right?
Yeah.
So what Morrell explains is after he writes the letter, they start to circulate it to all the people they want to sign it. And it's the usual suspects who we all know. So anyway, the way he drafted the letter was basically to say, we don't have any inside information, but this sure has the feel of Russian disinformation. So he gets a call or an email from our old friend James Clapper, the Obama administration national intelligence director. And he says that the verbiage would be stronger if we took feel out and we said that it had all the earmarks of a Russian influence operation. So Morrell thought that was a peachy editorial change and he made it. So that's how it happened. And it was done on a fast track because they knew they had to get it out for the debate. And the interesting thing is Morrell has to go to secrets to CIA because everybody from the CIA signs a lifetime disclosure agreement that you can't put out classified information and you have to get it approved by their review board at the CIA. So Morrell, who is just like Blinken is suspected that he's going to be the Secretary of State, people are thinking Morrell's going to be the CIA director if Biden wins. It didn't happen, but that was what the story was out there at the time. So the former and maybe soon to be CIA chief goes to the CIA and says, this is a rush job. We need this right away. And he sends it to them at 7 o'clock in the morning. By 5 in the evening, they sign off on it, which in government is like unheard of warp speed. But the other interesting thing is at the same time they're reviewing, the CIA is reviewing Morrell's letter. There's another guy named Karians, who is a former CIA agent, who's having his book reviewed by the review board before he publishes it. And while he's on the phone with them, the CIA says, have you heard about this letter that all these intelligence guys are signing about, you know, Trump and pushing back on the Biden laptop and all this stuff? And Karians ends up saying, I want to sign that letter. And it turns out his wife is also a former CIA agent, so she signs the letter too. So you have a situation where not only is Morrell putting this together, but the CIA is encouraging people to sign it. And even Morrell in his testimony said if that happened, that would have been a very bad abuse of power because the CIA has to stay out of politics. Because looking at this exercise, of course the CIA has to stay out. Turns out like I think 8/10 of the people who signed this were CIA-connected people. So, but the whole thing was done so that Biden would have a pushback against Trump. And the other thing that is kind of infuriating,
which he used.
And the other thing that's infuriating but true about Morrell's testimony is, you know, Morrell, they put in the letter this cover your ass thing that says basically that's the third thing I've said, Rich, on this family podcast. But they put in the CYA thing that says that, you know, we're not saying we have information or inside information about whether the laptop data is true or not, or, you know, this thing that they could rely on if somebody said that they were politicizing the intelligence later on. Who would make such an allegation as that, right? So when of course, they take, you know, pains to say that. And when they give the thing to Politico and then it swings around the left wing media, it doesn't get reported like that. It gets reported as former federal intelligence officials say that the Post reporting is misinformation. And they asked Morrell about that. And he said, well, look, when I wrote the letter, I knew the nuance we put in it was going to be ignored because politics and political reporting is the world of hyperbole. And he wasn't at all surprised when Biden used it the way Biden used it. So they knew exactly what they were doing when they did it, which is just, I mean, it's maddening. But yeah, the thing was orchestrated by the Biden campaign for sure.
So we don't have much time left, so we're going to skip over George Santos. Turns out that guy is not totally on the up and up, but had been having the time of his life in Congress prior to this. And I have to say, is pretty entertaining. My favorite Santos line was after Mitt Romney understandably rebuked him at the State of the Union, you don't belong here. And DeSantis was asked about it afterwards. He's like, I don't think that was very Mormon of him. But we'll skip that and come back to it next week. Let's hit the border real quick. We could have done an entire episode on this, but just let's take one bite at it. Title 42, the pandemic era measure that Trump used to help control the border, and there's been a big fight over it, and it's finally disappearing midnight tonight. The projections are 10,000 a day, but we already had 11,000 on Tuesday. What do you make of it?
It's a catastrophe. We have an editorial today in which we point out that Jay Johnson, when he was Obama's Homeland Security chief, said that if it got to be 1,000 a day, they knew that was a disaster. This is like a disaster cubed by the time we're done with this. The reporting, Rich, is that there may be 1 million people in Mexico who are going to storm the border. I've seen numbers between 700,000 and 1 million, and that's just for now. And the images are just, I mean, they're just, even for those of us who watch this closely, to watch these images of people crossing the Rio Grande, crossing into Brownsville, Texas, the lines that go on for miles and miles of people just streaming into our country, and knowing that Biden singularly caused this. This is like, yeah. I mean, in a sensible world, which, you know, every time we have a conversation like this, we realize how far we are from a sensible world. But in a sensible world, this would be the only thing. Our friggin' border has collapsed as a country. And it would be the only thing we'd be talking about. Mayorkas would already have been impeached, and Biden would be impeached. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.